page 82, in this way, at first slowly, in the later stages with ever-increasing rapidity, a man's casual body is built. At each stage of his growth, a study of the colors and striations of the causal body reveals the progress the ego has made since the causal body was first formed, when the entity emerged from the animal kingdom, and the exact stage of evolution at which he has now arrived. As we have seen, in the later stages of evolution, both the causal and mental bodies expand enormously, exhibiting the most gorgeous radiance of many colored lights, glowing with intense splendor when comparatively at rest, and sending forth dazzling coruscations when in high activity. As the causal body becomes able to express more and more of the ego, it extends further and further from its physical center, until a man is able to enfold hundreds and even thousands of persons within himself, and so exercise a vast influence for good. The pouring into the causal body of faculties acquired by a personality is analogous to the pouring into the group soul of the experiences acquired by the forms in which portions of the group soul incarnate. Thus, for example, supposing that the quality of accuracy is developed in a personality, when that quality goes back to the ego in the causal body, the same amount has to be spread over the whole causal body. The amount, which was quite sufficient to make one personality very accurate, when it goes into the ego, is only a fractional part of his requirements. He may consequently have many lives to develop enough of the quality to make it prominent in the next life, especially as the ego does not put into the next personality the same piece of himself but simply a piece of the whole mass of himself. The student must, all through his studies, recollect that the causal body is not the ego, but only such matter of the higher mental plane which has been vivified, and which expresses the qualities the ego has acquired. The real man himself, the divine trinity within, we may not see, but the more our sight and knowledge increase, the more nearly we approach that which veils itself in him. Thus we may think of the causal body as the nearest to a conception of the true man that our sight will at present give us. The student will recollect also, that it is by the size and shape of the causal body that are determined the size and shape of the mental body. In fact, the aura of a man, which has a definite size, is the same as that of a section of the causal body, and, as the causal body grows, that section becomes larger, and the man has a larger aura. Furthermore, in the case of a developed man, the mental body becomes a reflection of the causal body, since the man learns to follow solely the promptings of the higher self, and to guide his reason exclusively by them. In the process of meditation, vidi the mental body, page 160, as the mental body is stilled, the consciousness escapes from it, and passes into and out of the lower center, the neutral points of contact between the mental body and the causal body. The passage is accompanied by a momentary swoon, or, page 83, loss of consciousness, the inevitable result of the disappearance of objects of consciousness, followed by consciousness in the higher. The dropping out of objects of consciousness, belonging to the lower worlds, is thus followed by the appearance of objects of consciousness in the higher world. Then the ego can shape the mental body according to his own lofty thoughts, and permeate it with his own vibrations. He can mold it after the high visions of the planes beyond his own, of which he has caught a glimpse in his highest moments, and can thus convey downwards and outwards ideas to which the mental body would otherwise be unable to respond. Such ideas are the inspirations of genius, that flash down into the mind with dazzling light, and illuminate a world. We may here usefully repeat the substance of what was said in the mental body, page 160, etc., directing our attention now, not so much to the lower brain consciousness, as to that of the ego working in the causal body. Genius, which is of the ego, sees instead of arguing. True intuition is one of its faculties. The lower manas or mind, working in the brain apparatus, arranges facts, gathered by observation, balances them one against the other, and draws conclusions from them. By the process of ratiocination it operates, using the methods of induction and deduction. Intuition, on the other hand, as etymology indicates, is insight, looking within, a process as direct and swift as physical sight. It is the exercise of the eyes of intelligence, the unerring recognition of a truth presented on the mental plane. Proof is unnecessary, because it is above and beyond reason. Great care must, of course, be taken to distinguish mere karmic impulse from true intuition. It is only when the desires and appetites of the lower karmic self are stilled and at rest that the voice of the higher mind can make itself heard in the lower personality. In Isis Unveiled, pages 305-306, H.P. Blavatsky explains the matter with force and lucidity. Allied to the physical half of man's nature, she says, is reason, allied to his spiritual part is his conscience, which is that instantaneous perception between right and wrong which can be exercised by the spirit which, being a portion of divine wisdom and purity, is itself absolutely pure and wise. Its promptings are independent of reason, and can manifest themselves clearly only when they are unhampered by the base attractions of the lower nature. Reason, she points out, being wholly dependent on the evidence of other senses, cannot be a quality pertaining directly to the divine spirit. For spirit knows, hence reasoning is useless. Hence the ancient theurgists maintained that the rational part of man's soul, spirit, never entered wholly into the man's body, but only overshadowed him more or less through the irrational or astral soul, which serves as an intermediary, agent or medium between spirit and body. The man who has conquered matter sufficiently to receive the direct light from his shining orgiades, cp. 101, feels truth intuitionally. He could not err in his judgment notwithstanding all the sophisms suggested by reason, for he is illuminated. Hence prophecy, vaticination, and so-called divine inspiration are simply the effects of this illumination from above, by our own immortal spirit. As with a flame we might light a wick, and the color of the flame of the burning wick will depend on the nature of the wick, and of the liquid in which it is soaked, so in each human being the flame of manas sets alight the brain and karmic wick, and the color of the light from the wick will depend upon the karmic nature, and the development of the brain apparatus. Page 84, in her article on genius, H.P. Blavatsky explained this matter clearly. What we call the manifestations of genius in a person are only the more or less successful efforts of the ego to assert itself through its outer objective form. The egos of a Newton, an Aeschylus, a Shakespeare, are of the same essence and substance as the egos of a yokel, an ignoramus, a fool, or even an idiot. The self-assertion of their informing genii depends on the physiological and material construction of the physical man. No ego differs from another ego in its primordial or original essence and nature. That which makes of one mortal a great man and of another a vulgar, silly person is, as said, the quality and makeup of the shell or casing, the adequacy or inadequacy of brain and body to transmit and give expression to the light of the real inner man, the ego. To use a familiar simile, physical man is the instruments, the ego the performing artist. The potentiality of perfect melody rests in the instrument, and no skill of the artist can awaken faultless harmony out of a broken or badly constructed instrument. This harmony depends on the fidelity of transmission, by word and act, to the objective plane, of the unspoken divine thought in the very depths of man's subjective or inner nature, in a word, of his ego. Mental ability, intellectual strength, acuteness, subtlety, are manifestations of lower manas in man. They may reach as far as what H.P. Blavatsky spoke of as artificial genius, the outcome of culture and purely intellectual acuteness. Often its nature is demonstrated by the presence of karmic elements in it, that is, of passion, vanity, arrogance. At the present stage of human evolution, higher manas can but rarely manifest itself. Occasional flashes of it are what we call true genius. Behold in every manifestation of genius, when combined with virtue, the undeniable presence of the celestial exile, the divine ego whose jailer thou art, O man of matter. Such manifestations depend upon an accumulation of individual antecedent experiences of the ego in its preceding life or lives. For, although it is omniscient in its essence and nature, yet it still requires experience, through its personalities, of the things of earth, in order to apply the fruition of its abstract experience to them. And the cultivation of certain aptitudes, throughout a long series of incarnations, must finally culminate, in some one life, as genius, in one direction or another. It is clear from the above that, for the manifestation of true genius, purity of life is essential. It is important to recognize the part which the ego in the causal body plays in the formation of our conceptions of external objects. The vibrations of nerve threads present to the brain merely impressions. It is the work of the ego to classify, combine, and arrange them. The discrimination of the ego, acting through the mind, is brought to bear upon everything that the senses transmit to the brain. Furthermore, this discrimination is not an inherent instinct of the mind, perfect from the first, but is the result of the comparison of a number of previous experiences. Before considering the possibility of functioning consciously on the causal plane, we may remind ourselves that, for a man still attached to the physical body to move in full consciousness on the mental plane, that is either the lower or higher mental must be either an adept or one of their initiated pupils, for until a student has been taught by his master how to use his mental body he will be unable to move with freedom even upon its lower levels. Page 85, to function consciously during physical life upon the higher levels denotes, of course, still greater advancement, for it means the unification of the man, so that down here he is no longer a mere personality, more or less influenced by the individuality above, but is himself that individuality or ego. He is certainly still trammeled and confined by a body, but nevertheless he has within him the power and knowledge of a highly developed ego. At present, most people are not more than just conscious in the causal body. They can work only in the matter of the third subplane, that is the lowest part of the causal body, and in fact only the lowest matter even of it is usually in operation. When they are on the path, the second subplane opens up. The adept, of course, uses the whole causal body, while his consciousness is on the physical plane. These details will be considered fully in a later chapter. Passing now to more specific and detailed powers of the causal body, it will be recollected, as explained in the two preceding volumes of this series, that it is not possible for a man to pass to another planet of our chain either in his astral or his mental body. In the causal body, however, when very highly developed, this achievement is possible, though even then by no means with the ease or the rapidity with which it can be done on the buddhic plane, by those who have succeeded in raising their consciousness to that level. It appears, however, that a causal body would not normally be able to move in interstellar space. In that space it seems that the atoms lie apart and equidistant, and this is probably their normal condition when undisturbed. That is what is meant by speaking of the atoms as free. Within the atmosphere of a planet they are never found at all in that state, for even when they are not grouped in forms, they are at any rate enormously compressed by the force of attraction. In interplanetary space, the conditions are probably not exactly the same as in interstellar space, for there may be a great deal of disturbance due to cometic and meteoric matter, and also the tremendous attraction of the Sun produces a considerable compression within the limits of this system. Hence the atomic matter of a man's causal body is crushed together by attraction into a definite and quite dense shape, even though the atoms are in no way altered in themselves, and are not grouped into molecules. While such a body can exist comfortably on its own atomic plane, in the neighborhood of a planet, where the atomic matter is compressed, it would not be able to move or function in faraway space where the atoms are free and uncompressed. The power of magnification belongs to the causal body, and is associated with the brow chakram, the force center between the eyebrows. From the central portion of this chakram what may be called a tiny microscope is projected, having for its lens only one atom. In this way an organ is produced, commensurate in size with the minute objects to be observed. The atom employed may be either physical, astral or mental, but, whichever it is, it needs a special preparation. All its spirally must be opened up, so that it is just as it will be in the seventh round of our chain of worlds. If an atom of a level lower than the causal be used as an eyepiece, a system of reflecting counterparts, page 86, must be introduced. The atom can be adjusted to any subplane, so that any required degree of magnification can be applied, in order to suit the object which is being examined. A further extension of the same power enables the operator to focus his own consciousness in the lens through which he is looking, and then to project it to distant points. The same power, by a different arrangement, can be used for diminishing purposes, when one wishes to view as a whole something far too large to be taken in at once by ordinary vision. The sight of the causal body enables one to foresee the future to some extent. Even with physical senses, one may sometimes foretell certain things. Thus, for example, if we see a man leading a life of debauchery, we may safely predict that, unless he changes, he will presently lose health and fortune. What we cannot tell, by physical means, is whether the man will change or not. But a man who has the sight of the causal body could often tell this, because to him the reserve forces of the other would be visible. He could see what the ego thought of it all, and whether he was strong enough to interfere. No merely physical prediction is certain, because so many of the causes which influence life, cannot be seen on this lower plane. But, when the consciousness is raised to higher planes, we can see more of the causes, and so can come nearer to calculating the effects. It is, of course, easier to foresee the future of an undeveloped man than of one more advanced. For the ordinary man has little willpower, karma assigns him certain surroundings, and he is the creature of those surroundings, he accepts fate marked out for him, because he does not know that he can alter it. A more developed man, however, takes hold of his destiny, and molds it semicolon he makes his future what he wills it to be, counteracting the karma of the past by setting fresh forces in motion. Hence his future is not so easily predictable. But no doubt even in this case an adept, who could see the latent will, could also calculate how he would use it. Students of the mental body will recollect that there is the given a description of the Akashic records, or the memory of nature, as it is sometimes called. In reading these records, the work is done through the causal body, the mental body vibrating only in response to the activity of the causal body. For that reason, no satisfactory or reliable reading of the records can be done without definite development of the causal body. C. W. Leadbeater describes an interesting and unusual case where, through reckless mental overwork, a man so aroused the faculties of his causal body that he was able, spasmodically, to read the records with great clarity of detail. In addition, he was able to exercise the power of magnification, to some extent, particularly in regard to perfumes. The result, which is characteristic of this faculty, was a roughening of a smell, the smell losing its smoothness, and becoming like woolen cloth, so to say, or a basin of sand. The reason for this is that the faculty of magnification, which belong to the causal body, causes tiny physical particles which arouse in us the sense of smell to become separately appreciable, like the grains on sandpaper, and so the sense of roughness is produced. Page 87. Needless to say, this method of arousing the powers of the causal body by overwork is strongly to be deprecated, as it is far more likely to result in breakdown of the brain or nervous system than, as happened in this rare instance, to arouse causal faculties. If a man raises his consciousness to the highest subdivision of his causal body, and focuses it exclusively in the atomic matter of the mental plane, he has before him three possibilities of moving his consciousness, which correspond to some extent with the three dimensions of space. Obviously, 1. A way is open to him to move it downwards into the second subplane of the mental, or upward into the lowest subplane of the buddhic, provided of course that he has developed his buddhic body sufficiently to be able to utilize it as a vehicle. 2. A second line of movement is the shortcut from the atomic subdivision of one plane to the corresponding atomic subdivision of the planes above or below, without touching any of the intermediate subplanes. 3. A third possibility is not so much a movement along another line, at right angles to both of these others, but rather a possibility to looking up such a line, the line that joins the ego and the monad, much as a man at the bottom of a well might look up at a star in the sky above him. For there is a direct line of communication between the atomic subplane of the mental in this lowest cosmic plane and the corresponding atomic mental in the cosmic mental plane. Although we are as yet infinitely far from being able to climb upwards by that line, Yet C.W.Leadbeater states that once at least the experience came of being able to look up it for a moment. What is seen, he says, it is hopeless to try to describe, for no human words can give the least idea of it. But at least this much emerges, with a certitude that can never be shaken, that what we have hitherto supposed to be our consciousness, our intellect, is simply not ours at all, but his. Not even a reflection of his, but literally and truly a part of his consciousness, a part of his intellect. Some little help in understanding this may be derived from the knowledge that the human ego itself is a manifestation of the third outpouring which comes from his first aspect, the eternal and all-loving Father. The growth and development of the causal body is greatly assisted by the work of the masters, for they deal more with egos in their causal bodies than with the lower vehicles of men. They devote themselves to the pouring of spiritual influence upon men, raying out, as the sunlight radiates upon flowers, thereby evoking from them all that is noblest and best in them, and so promoting their growth. Many people are sometimes conscious of helpful influences of this description, but are quite unable to trace them to their source. This work will be explained somewhat more fully in a later chapter. Page 88, Chapter 19, Life After Death, The Fifth Heaven. In the astral body and the mental body we have dealt with the life of the man after death on the astral plane, and also on the lower mental plane, in his mental body, in the first, second, third and fourth heaven worlds, on the seventh, sixth, fifth and fourth sub-planes respectively. We now have to describe the life after death in the causal body, on the three higher levels of the mental plane. The distinction between the two great divisions of the mental plane, the lower or rupa, form, and the higher or arupa, formless, is very marked. So different, indeed, are the two worlds, that different vehicles of consciousness are necessary for functioning in them. In the mental body, pages 202-204, the general rationale and purpose of the life in Devachan has already been explained, and so need not be repeated here. It was also explained in that book why Devachan is a necessity for the great majority of people. In certain exceptional cases, however, we saw that a man sufficiently advanced, with the permission of a very high authority, may renounce Devachan, and take a series of rapid incarnations, without any appreciable intervals between them. In the lower mental plane, matter is dominant, it is the first thing that strikes the eye, and consciousness shines with difficulty through the forms. But in the higher planes life is the most prominent thing, and forms are there only for its purposes. The difficulty in the lower planes is to give the life expression in the forms, in the higher, it is the reverse, to hold and give form to the flood of life. It is only above the dividing line between the lower and higher mental planes that the light of consciousness is subject to no wind, and shines with its own power. The symbol of a spiritual fire is very fitting for consciousness at those levels, as distinguished from the lower planes, where the symbol of fire-burning fuel is more appropriate. In the arupa levels, matter is subordinated to life, altering at every moment. An entity changes form with every change of thought. Matter is an instrument of his life and is no expression of himself. The form is made momentarily, and it changes with every change of his life. This is true not only of the arupa levels, of manas, but also in a subtle way of the plane of buddhi, and it is true also of the spiritual ego. Glorious as has been the life in the heaven worlds of the lower mental plane, it eventually comes to an end. The mental body in its turn drops away, as have done the other bodies, and the man's life in his causal body begins. All through the heaven life, the personality of the last physical life is distinctly preserved, and it is only when the consciousness is finally withdrawn into the causal body that this feeling of personality is merged in the individuality, and the man for the first time since his descent into incarnation realizes himself as the true and comparatively permanent ego. In the causal body the man needs no windows which, as the student will recollect, were formed by his own thoughts in the lower heavens. For this, the causal plane, is his true home, and all his walls have fallen away. Page 89, the majority of men have as yet very little consciousness at this height, they rest dreamily unobservant and scarcely awake. Such vision, however, as they have is true, however limited it may be for lack of development. The higher heaven world life plays a very small part in the life of the ordinary man, for in his case the ego is not sufficiently developed to be awake in the causal body. Backward egos, in fact, never consciously attain the heaven world at all, while in a still larger number obtain only a comparatively slight touch of the lower subplanes. But in the case of a man who is spiritually developed, his life, as an ego in his own world, is glorious and fully satisfying. Nevertheless, consciously or unconsciously, every human being must touch the higher levels of the mental plane, before reincarnation can take place. As his evolution proceeds, this touch, of course, becomes more and more definite and real to him. Not only is he more conscious there as he progresses, but the period he passes in that world of reality becomes longer, for his consciousness is slowly but steadily rising through the different planes of the system. The time spent in the higher mental world may vary, according to the stage of development, from 2 or 3 days of unconsciousness, in the case of an ordinary undeveloped man, to a long period of years of conscious and glorious life, in the case of exceptionally advanced people. The length of time spent in the heaven worlds between incarnations is dependent upon 3 principal factors, 1, the class to which an ego belongs, 2, the mode in which he attained individualization, and, 3, the length and nature of his last life. As this matter has been treated in detail in the Mental Body, Chapter 21, it is unnecessary to repeat here what was said there. Even when we have fully realized how small a part of each life cycle is spent on the physical plane, in order fairly to estimate its true proportion to the whole, we must also bear thoroughly in mind the far greater reality of the life in the higher worlds. This is a point which it is impossible to emphasize too strongly, for the vast majority of people are as yet so entirely under the dominion of their physical senses, that the unrealities of the lower world seem to them the only reality, whilst the nearer anything approaches to true reality, the more unreal and incomprehensible it appears to them. For reasons which are sufficiently comprehensible, the astral world has been called the world of illusion, but it is nevertheless at least one step nearer to reality, far indeed as is the astral sight from the clear, all-embracing vision of the man on his own plane. It is at least keener and more reliable than physical sense. And as is the astral to the physical, so is the mental to the astral, except that the proportion is raised to a higher power. Hence not only is the time spent on these higher planes far longer than the physical life, but every moment of it may, if properly used, be enormously more fruitful than the same amount of time on the physical plane could possibly be. Page 90, as evolution proceeds, the principle governing the life after death is that life on the lower levels, both of the astral and the mental planes, gradually shortens, while the higher life becomes steadily longer and fuller. Eventually the time arrives when the consciousness is unified, that is, when the higher and the lower selves are indissolubly united, and the man is no longer capable of wrapping himself up in his own cloud of thought, and mistaking the little that he can see through for the whole of the great heaven world around him. Then he realizes the possibilities of his life, and so for the first time truly begins to live. But, by the time that he attains these heights, he will already have entered upon the path, and taken his future progress definitely into his own hands. It is only when the consciousness has withdrawn from the lower bodies, and is once more centered in the ego, that the final result of the incarnation just concluded is known. Then it is seen what new qualities he has acquired in that particular little cycle of his evolution. At that time also, a glimpse of the life as a whole is obtained. The ego has for a moment a flash of clearer consciousness, in which he sees the results of the life just completed, and something of what will follow from it in his next birth. This glimpse can hardly be said to involve a knowledge of the nature of the next incarnation, except in the vaguest and the most general sense. No doubt the main object of the coming life would be seen, and the specific progress which he is intended to make in it, but the vision would be chiefly valuable as a lesson in the karmic result of his action in the past. It offers him an opportunity, of which he takes more or less advantage, according to the stage of development to which he has attained.